stopped being completely cool.
Well, anyway, thanks, guys. I hope you enjoyed our hour of nonsense. We'll see you again next week. Stay frosty.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, your weekly roundup of the latest limestone local news. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. In today's episode, we'll be covering some of the latest updates directly from City Hall. Without further delay, let's dive right in. At their last meeting, Council approved a bylaw to temporarily prohibit clear-cutting in the midst of several moving pieces surrounding tree protection in the city. Councillor Osanek brought the motion forward, with the intent of pressing pause while Council awaits a natural heritage study review, the new official plan, and potential updates to toughen the city's current tree bylaw.
The intent of this bylaw is to prevent any further avoidable loss of woodland canopy in advance of our policies coming forward with the natural heritage study. We had all hoped that the natural heritage study policies would already be before us. It looks like it's going to be not until June now, and that's when the official plan, all those policies should be coming forward. We need these policies for the natural heritage so badly. And so this bylaw is to, take us until that point in time.
There are some exceptions to the law, including permits and approval directly from council. Enforcement of the bylaw will be through administrative monetary penalties, with a base penalty of $5,000 for prohibited clear-cutting, plus $5,000 per 0.1 hectares of trees cleared in contravention of the bylaw. For more serious or repeat offenses, proceedings may be initiated under Part 3 of the Provincial Offenses Act. When asked about enforcement, staff provided the following response to council.
Of course, staff resources are limited, so like most bylaws, we'd be approaching this on a reactive approach. Certainly, if there are complaints from members of the public about alleged clear-cutting activity, those residents are encouraged to reach out to the city's bylaw enforcement division for further investigation.
Councillors supported the motion unanimously, with Councillor Connie Glenn noting the importance of taking time to slow down while the future strategy of protecting the city's tree canopy takes shape.
I do hope that everyone here will support this. I think that this is a reasonable measure. We are in the midst of a lot of change right now. We have seen some things happen that have the community rightly concerned. I'm certainly disheartened and concerned about the fast pace of some of the cutting that we've seen, and without discussion given, I think everyone in the city knows we're in the midst of a new heritage, a natural heritage study review. They know that we're in the middle of an official plan. This is an opportunity for the whole community to slow down and reorient itself to what our future is going to look like. We know that there are high growth demands here, but how do we manage that while preserving the things that we value most? So I hope that everyone sees that this is a reasonable temporary measure to get us to that next stage where we've got clear rules and a clear understanding amongst the entire community about how we move forward.
The temporary ban on clear-cutting will remain in effect until the city's new official plan comes into force, or until council otherwise amends or repeals the bylaw. Council is looking at a new way to protect the city's tree canopy by rewarding preservation, not just penalizing destruction. At their last meeting, councillors unanimously approved a motion directing staff to explore the creation of a municipal tree conservation incentive program, with a report expected back by the end of 2026. The motion also comes alongside a temporary bylaw passed at the same meeting, which prohibits clear-cutting unless specifically approved, as the city continues a broader review of tree protection policies launched in February. Councillor Ryan Boehm, who brought the motion forward after a conversation with a constituent, says this move is about shifting the approach.
You know, we're looking at the temporary bylaw, we're looking at fines and everything like that, but this was brought forward by a community member when I was sitting in a Tim Hortons, that why are there not really incentives? And so the whole idea here is that Finding somebody once they've cut down an old growth forest accomplishes a punitive measure, but it doesn't change the fact that the forest wasn't protected and that it's gone. And then it's very hard to reestablish. It takes hundreds of years for that. So the whole goal here is let's incentivize and see what programs exist at the provincial level and perhaps further, you know, bump them up at the municipal level to have people actually voluntarily protect certain forests for an extended amount of time and commit to that. And letting land be unused has so many benefits, but there are also costs for those people who are leaving it in that natural state. So what we want to try to do is reduce those costs. So we've taken the stick approach with some previous motions. Herein now lies the carrot. So I think it's great when we have issues that we can approach it from two different angles, try to incentivize it.
City staff will now look at what can be done on the municipal level, including both tax-based and non-tax incentives, while staying within legislative limits. Staff are expected to report back with options, costs, and best practices by the end of the year. Kingston residents will have to wait longer than expected for the return of a major aquatic facility. At their last meeting, Council received an update on the construction of the Culligan Water Park enclosure, revealing the project has been delayed. While it was originally expected to be completed by summer 2027, the timeline has now been pushed to November of 2027, meaning the city will go another full summer without the facility. The Culligan Water Park has been a Kingston summer staple since 2011, heavily utilized by residents across the city for a variety of aquatic programming. Construction began in October 2025 with contractor Emmons & Mitchell working to enclose the park, a move which will allow for year-round use, helping to relieve pressure on other city pools that are already operating at capacity. But for now, that relief is on hold. The report to council states that the cause of the delay is due to several fixed sequencing constraints in the construction process, limiting opportunities to speed up the timeline. When asked by councillors, staff provided further detail.
Some of the delays were associated just with the sequencing of the work. So when we set up the summer of 2027 opening, we had the preliminary schedule that the general contractor provided. As they secured all their contracts and issued all their POs for various equipment and stuff, it became obvious that the schedule would have to be extended by about 4 months. And we're working now to see how we can bring it back. But like, for example, the pool needs, the slide needs a crane to erect it. And then the steel needs to go around it. So we're looking at ways to erect the steel and the structure and then erect the slide afterwards inside to shorten the critical path that it takes. But the other big challenge is that we're working with an existing pool and the basin is there. So you have to work around an existing pool that the exact scope and the timing wasn't taken into account when we set up the original schedule.
The news raised concern around the horseshoe, especially given the already high demand for pool space in Kingston. Aquatic programming, especially access to swim lessons for young children, has been a growing issue in recent years, with families struggling to secure spots. Councillor Don Amos expressed his concern.
It's disappointing that our families are now going to go another summer without utilizing that pool. So we know that there are pool shortages in this area, and this is putting pressure on our families just wanting to learn to enjoy swim lessons and recreation swimming. So I'll leave it at that.
Adding to the impact, councillors also learned that the heavily used splash pad located next to the park will be closed for summer 2026 and potentially 2027 as well. This is due to its proximity to the construction site and associated safety concerns.
That's highly utilized without the Culligan Water Park open. I know a lot of families like that as a free sort of way to cool off.
If we could try as hard as possible to get the splash pad open, because that's something that a lot of people have approached me about, is asking about, is the splash pad going to be open in 2026? But obviously it won't be. So if we could try to for 2027 and maybe have something that close by that people can do during the summer, that would be great if we can think of something.
In response, the city's Recreation and Leisure Services Department is working to fill the gap. Staff have secured more than 300 hours of additional swim time from partner aquatic facilities for summer 2026, which will be used for swim lessons, family swims, and lane swims. However, staff note that even with these additions, the city will fall short of meeting demand and say they will continue working with partners to expand programming where possible.
We will be entering into agreements with other aquatic partners such as BGC and Queens to offer programming. So this summer is nearly secured pending final agreements, and we anticipate doing something similar next summer and ensuring that Artillery Park also has programming to help alleviate some of the gaps there. As well as Commissioner Campbell mentioned, the pool in Loyalist, the Aquatic Center, is currently under construction, their new center, and so residents will also have the opportunity to use that facility. As the city has made a capital contribution to ensure Kingston residents have the same access as Loyalist residents.
It was clarified that the delay will not impact the overall cost of construction. The additional swim time secured for 2026 is covered within the existing budget, though similar funding estimated at just over $50,000 will be needed again in 2027. For now, residents are left navigating another summer with limited access to aquatic programming, as the city waits for the long-anticipated build, still more than a year away from completion. Before we get into more local news this evening, let's take a look at your weather and traffic report for the rest of the week with CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region, Thursday, April 16th, the first day of the week not to be projected to have rain. Daytime high of 14 degrees, going to feel closer to 13, cloudy conditions dropping down to 9 overnight. Friday, April 17th, another high double-digit day, 16 degrees, but we do have a 55% chance of precipitation that will cool things off quite a bit overnight, dropping down to 2, and cooling things off for the weekend, as Saturday, April 18th, we have a high of 10 degrees with a mix of sun and cloud, feeling slightly colder around 8. Sunday, April 19th, we've got an 11-degree day in the forecast with a mix of sun and cloud, but it is actually going to feel quite a bit warmer than the 11-degree temperature in the sun. It'll feel up to 16 on Sunday, April 19th. And then starting off next week, Monday, April 20th, daytime high of 11 degrees, but a 62% chance of rain means it's going to feel closer to 8. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week, and just bear in mind, winter overnight street parking restrictions have been lifted as of April 1st. We begin with two long-term road closures. Berry Street to Queen is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. We have some short-term road closures as well, including Wright Crescent at Palace Road, which is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. There is a minimal traffic disruption on Bath Road to Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard. Expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing intersection pedestrian signals at several locations to make it easier and safer for pedestrians to cross busy roads. They are installing these signals at the following intersections: Bath Road at Lafleur Park, Concession Street at Kings Court Avenue, and Stephen Street at Patrick Street. And that's a wrap for your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Safe driving, everybody.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. A group of medical students at Queen's University are organizing action aimed at addressing housing and homelessness in Kingston. While it's called the Queen's Medicine Municipal Day of Action, the work has been underway for weeks. Students have been meeting with local service providers, community organizations, and experts, and are now bringing their findings directly to city councilors. The last time the event was held was in 2021, also focusing on housing and homelessness. This year marks a five-year follow-up, as homelessness in Kingston has risen by 133% over that period. First-year medical student Zara Rahman and second-year student Tim Song spoke with CFRC about how the initiative came together.
So this initiative is called the Medical Day of Action, or the Municipal Medical Day of Action, and it is run by a team of medical students right here at Queen's. There are a lot of similar initiatives that happen all across Canada, whether it's through province, whether it's through the entire nation, where we meet up in Ottawa. And we wanted to do something more local here in Kingston as a group of medical students. So the Medical Student Society, also called the Aesculapian Society, has a group of medical students who are specifically working towards equity and advocacy as a committee. And these medical students work independently to do different things around Kingston and around Queens to try to make a difference. For example, we host fundraisers. For example, we host different awareness events. And this year, we wanted to bring back an event that's happened previously at Queens, the School of Medicine, called the Day of Action. So that's kind of how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is the first time this has come back since 2021. I was wondering if you could speak to why you decided to bring it back now and why revisit this topic.
Yes, for sure. So this initiative used to be a lot bigger pre-COVID, where people were able to meet in person. Basically, as a quick overview of what a day of action is it basically is a bunch of medical students or health professionals looking through the community, whether it's municipal, provincial, or national, like I stated before, to see if there's any issues that as medical students or health professionals we could address. So this was a lot easier to do, as you can imagine, to try to talk to city councilors or talk to municipal government in person. So over COVID, it kind of died down. But just as a example of a few different things that the Kingston team used to work on includes water fluoridation, very important. We don't have that here in Kingston, as well as homelessness relief or housing for the precariously housed, which is, again, a very pertinent issue here in the Kingston community. So as things got back to coming in person and we started having more lively discussions about how we can make a change here at Queen's, the first thing we kind of stumbled upon was this program called Municipal Day of Action. And as we were looking back at past references, talking to past organizers to see what would be a good fit for us moving forward, we found that the topic that they addressed in 2021, housing and homelessness, would be a perfect fit based on all of the pertinent issues that are happening here in Kingston today.
And to add on, we felt like it was very important in the times that we're in right now. So since 2021, homelessness in Kingston has risen. And we've also seen that there are a lot of different barriers. And I think even looking at this politically on how much of this becomes a pertinent topic, this is something that is continuously discussed. And we felt that it may be best for us as medical students to advocate for our future patients, especially considering all the different barriers and how health, there's so much more research coming out now, especially since COVID, on how the social determinants of health. So for those who don't know, those are kind of just factors in your life like income or housing and how much that can actually impact your health. It's not usually just, you know, exercise or diet. It can also be where you live, how much money you have, what access to resources you have. And we found, at least through our research, that with homelessness rising in Kingston, there's also a reduction in those health outcomes as well. And then that could also tie into other issues like wait times in hospitals, for example, in emergency wait times, for example. So we kind of looked at this more holistically as we went throughout our research.
From their consultations, the group developed two key asks for council, focused on improving housing services and health outcomes for unhoused residents. The first calls for better data collection and coordination across services.
We kind of did a more of a deep dive into the research. We looked into health outcomes. We looked into how different municipalities approach this. And one thing we found, as Tim mentioned, was data and the importance of it. So when we did the deep dive, we looked into, so United Way, for example, in Kingston does a lot of data checks. So there's something called the by name list. So not going into the specifics because it is quite complex, but basically the by name list identifies the individuals who are unhoused in Kingston. And these are individuals that are comfortable being recognized and has all of their data, and it allows us to keep track on them and make sure that they're okay. And the way that the city of Kingston does it right now is that they just list how many people are unhoused. So for example, I believe currently it's over 500 in 2025. But as we've mentioned before, there are a lot of barriers to that data, and it may not give the full holistic idea of what's going on, and that can impact what policies we're able to provide in Kingston. So the ask that we have right now is to make sure that that data, so the by name list, or there's something called the Homeless Individuals and Families Information System, has a good idea of who is being unhoused and then who is being housed, so inflow and outflow. And this is important to have, you know, for example, either on housing for homelessness, like as an annual report, just to make sure we have an idea as the city to know where people are at, where folks are at, and to see what different barriers they're experiencing. And then also having a good monthly report card. So I believe it was either United Way or one of the community organizations that did an evaluation on the data and the situation of homelessness in Kingston. And they found that, unfortunately, the data is just not as well upkept in Kingston. So there is that gap. They reported this as being a huge barrier. I believe it's only updated monthly. And sometimes there can be difficulties in recognizing who's being housed and who's not being unhoused. Because when you're living, for example, on the street, and then you were housed and then now you're not housed, that's a day by day. You're surviving day by day, not month by month. So we also looked into other jurisdictions. One, for example, is in Hamilton and the Durham District as well. So in Hamilton, what they do is that they have a lot of comprehensive data. So they not only provide like how many people are unhoused in Kingston, but how many people were housed, how many people are, for example, of different marginalized communities, how many of them are women, how many of them are Indigenous, and then how many of those have been approached, for example, by someone to get housed. So I think that provides more of a realistic idea of what's going on the ground versus just these are how many people are unhoused. And I think that can really benefit one, the government, the municipal government, especially just to figure out when you are coming up with policies, what support you can give. But also I think for the people of Kingston, I think that this would allow for a lot more grace and I think a lot more empathy if you just have an idea of what someone is experiencing and the different layers of it versus just seeing a number. Because we as individuals are not just numbers. We all have different stories. And I think having that data would be able to have that better picture of what's going on.
Their second ask emphasizes incorporating Indigenous housing models into local approaches.
So as medical students, we often see, or we often try to look at which populations are more vulnerable or more susceptible to different health issues. It's the social determinants of health that Zara talked about earlier. And the thing that we, I guess, focused on this year was the sheer number or sheer disproportionate number of Indigenous individuals mm-hmm. who are experiencing homelessness, not just in Kingston, but globally. We talked to a lot of different community groups here in Kingston itself. We had a conversation with the Language Nest. We talked to 4D. We talked to the Ikanu Patient Services, which is a group that works up with the James Bay Indigenous folk and bringing them back and forth with KGH. And basically, we've decided that we want to ask for more Indigenous-led housing, culturally grounded prevention services, wraparound supports, and basically just strengthening the city of Kingston's truth and reconciliation commitments. So all this to say, for both ask and ask two, for ask one and ask two, the city has been doing amazing work. Mm-hmm. When we talk to some of the different organizations like the Canadian Association for Ending Homelessness, they listed that Kingston is doing a great job in addressing homelessness. So again, for the second ask, it's kind of more of a push towards you're doing a great job towards supporting Indigenous initiatives. We want to see more. We want you to keep doing what you're doing and kind of push that forward. Mm-hmm. So a few different ways that, again, it's a very broad ask. Support, strengthen truth and reconciliation commitments. Very broad, very abstract, if that makes sense. So a few different ways that we're kind of hoping that could go about its way could potentially be continuing to invest in more Indigenous-led supportive transitional housing initiatives. So we had a conversation with Tippi Moza, mm-hmm. which is the supportive housing, one of the main supportive housing organizations here in Kingston. And they suggested that one aspect of supportive housing that could be important was maybe having more Indigenous-specific housing centers or complexes. Right now, the Language Nest is working on helping individuals who identify as Indigenous to find housing or put in applications. And by having a center that's specifically investing in more Indigenous-led supportive housing would be really beneficial to the community at large. Another way could do this would be to increase municipal funding. Mm-hmm. Another way could do this could be to look at how the Indigenous Community Land Trust I guess, fits into the implementation of different strategies for building housing in the future, and potentially looking into an Indigenous care center, which basically means working with the local Indigenous partners like the Language Nest to identify a site, maybe funding pathways and implementation timelines to move basically a comprehensive care center forward.
Students are now meeting with city councillors throughout the month of April and hope to bring the conversation to the provincial level as well. Ramon and Song say they've already been getting a response from the Kingston community.
From those initial conversations, I think a lot of folks were really happy that we were talking about it. They were really, the reactions that I've received was a lot of hope and a lot of just hoping that things can get better, and a lot of gratefulness as well that people were looking into this, especially as medical professionals. And from the physicians that we've spoken with in our class, so for example, I did an announcement and one of our professors was talking to our class about how important it is to discuss the social determinants of health, to look at medicine outside of just what we learn in a lecture hall, but rather, and just slides, but rather the lived experiences of individuals. And then we've heard that echoed from our peers as well. So a lot of our peers have been approaching us, like a lot of folks, for example, in the first year class have approached me about how excited they are for this initiative to be able to make a difference and to also want to join this initiative if they haven't, like, you know, gotten the chance to. And I think that this shows a lot of optimism and hope that is kind of missing from the public discourse recently. I think things have been really down and sucky for the past few years just with how, I don't know, like how life has been. And I think that this offers a lot of hope and glimmer of optimism that a lot of medical students are approaching with and a lot of faculty members and committee members are approaching with.
I would also say that humility has been a big aspect of our community consultation, especially as it's been a lot of learning as we talk to all these amazing organizations and speaking about all the very important and invaluable work that they've done.
Looking ahead as the group dives into conversations with counselors, the group hopes this work will have a positive impact in the Kingston community and continue to grow as an ongoing initiative within Queen's Medicine.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see where this will go. I think that one of the things that really excited me when I first wanted to bring back this event as one of the co-chairs of the Equity and Access Committee was the fact that medical students could have so much fun learning and being so involved in the community as Queen's Medical students with Kingston. I feel a lot of the times that Queen's itself feels like a big bubble where we're just nestled into downtown, not really focusing on anything else that happens in Kingston. And the School of Medicine is a smaller bubble embedded within the bigger bubble where we don't even talk to oftentimes the rest of Queens. So I think that this way, having an outlet for people to be able to contribute to the community or learn about the community through advocacy and equity, which are big foundational, I guess, skill sets that medicine or doctors needs, I think is such a great way to, I guess, be connected and understand what's going on, not only with Kingston, but also with our own beliefs and values. I think that this will hopefully be an initiative that continues to grow, not only for medical students, but also for Kingston itself.
I think like developing a culture within Queen's Medicine, but even other medical schools, for example, or even within Queens, on how important it is for us to support our own community and be responsible for our own community. It goes down to that very basic idea of humanity that I think is always echoed in, you know, the humanities, medicine, but any field where you help someone that is in need because you are a human being and that person matters. And the benefit of another person is a benefit for myself as well. So I think that is one thing that we hope to see in medicine, especially as we progress in our careers, as we progress to become, you know, residents or attendings, that we carry this with us, this idea of community consultation, learning from others, humility, and just the humanity aspect, the compassionate care aspect.
That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. To revisit episodes and listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters.
Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hi, I'm Steve Swellsy Wells, and I'm extraordinarily excited to invite you to Ganspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th at the Royal Theatre in Gananoque. Come rock out with MC Shansky, Gananoque's poet laureate Gretchen Huntley, and listen and dance to some great rocking grooves by Pudge, The Red Handed, and my band Triple J, all in support of the Gananoque and Area Food Bank. Advance tickets are available now for $20 through Eventbrite, or by emailing me at ganspringrock@gmail.com. You can also help by buying one of our incredible GanRocks 2026 t-shirts and participating in our fundraising auction on Facebook, featuring wonderful gifts from local businesses, all in support of a great cause. So take a look on Facebook for GanRocks, and I'm looking forward to seeing you at Ganspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th.
Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a Cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
Today on Wings.
Nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
If you're going to create a censorship magic wand, you also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves, rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
This is Suki Wessling of The Babblery. Cindy Cohen, the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has led the fight for online privacy for nearly 30 years. Cohen joined the nonprofit in 1993 when she was asked to lead a lawsuit against the United States Department of Justice in a groundbreaking case regarding cryptography. And if you want to hear her talk technicalities, she's fully able to do so. But I reached out to Cindy to ask if I could engage her in a much more accessible conversation about women's online privacy. She readily agreed to join me and says that there are deep systemic problems with the way we interact with the internet.
We didn't get into the problems with the internet, which is one thing. So there isn't just one quick fix, but there are a few things we could do that would make things much better. And the first is comprehensive privacy protection.
In this episode, you'll hear one thing right away. Cindy Cohen is, as you'd expect from EFF, a fierce defender of online privacy and free speech. In this conversation, we explore some of the common arguments in favor of restricting online privacy and how guaranteeing privacy and freedom of speech for all bumps up against personal freedoms and safety. I started by asking Cindy to define what online privacy is.
So I think of privacy as maybe a little different than some people do. Some people think of privacy like the Harry Potter invisibility cloak that you throw over your head, you know, when you're about to do something you don't want somebody else to find out about it. Well, you know, privacy does that. I'm not saying it doesn't. But the reason I think privacy is important, and far more important than that, is because privacy is a way that people with less power can have a zone of protection from people who have more power. And I think about this from the very smallest to the very biggest level. On the very smallest level, my colleague, Eva Galperin, works with domestic violence victims, you know, a lot of women. And what do they find out? They find out that their abusers have put malware on their devices so that they can track them all the time, so that they don't have any privacy against their abusers. And they need privacy in order to plot their escape, in order to literally protect their lives from someone who's abusing them. That's how privacy works literally in people's houses. And then you can scale, you know, halfway, which privacy is how we get protection from the corporations who increasingly want to use all the information they know about us to, say, decide how much we're going to pay for things and maximize how much we might want to pay, or decide what options we get when we're searching for a job, and those kinds of things that are more on the commercial side. But just as important, they have more power because they know more about us, and they use that power, they can leverage that power against us. And then out a little bigger, and you think about your role as a citizen, you know, we have the private vote in America. We have a secret ballot so that powerful people can't force you to vote for the person they want you to vote for. So it's your decision, not theirs. And those powerful people could be anywhere from your husband to your employer to the government in power. But that's why we have a private ballot in the United States. But it's also the way that people organize to make change. Every public fight for social justice in the United States has needed to have a private space for it to grow. And in my lifetime, we've watched gay rights, for instance, go from something that really people had to talk about in private because it was not popular and people could, you know, literally be attacked for standing up for these things, to the place where, you know, hopefully we can keep it, but the United States Supreme Court has recognized gay marriage and gay people have rights that are much closer to what they deserve than they had when this started out. But every public fight for people's rights has had to have a private dimension, especially in the early days. And I think people are seeing that now in the current administration, maybe a little more than they did in the past. People are recognizing that you need to use a privacy protective tool in order to organize and plan things, because otherwise it will get intercepted by people with more power who want to make sure that we all stay weak and powerless and unable to make changes to our government.
I asked Cindy about the current Republican-led state intrusion into medical records, specifically in the areas of pregnancy and transgender health, but with hints that they could cast the net more widely. These intrusions of women's privacy happened after the case that enshrined abortion rights, Roe v. Wade, was overturned. Some argue that the case was weak because it rested on privacy, which is not explicitly guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. Cindy disagrees.
I think that when the Fourth Amendment says you deserve to be secure in your papers, your home, and your effects, that's what it means. But we don't have the Supreme Court interpreting it that way as much as we should right now. And that's some of the work that EFF and others are doing in the courts, but that really we do need people to recognize that, you know, the word privacy doesn't have to be in the Constitution. Privacy protective ideas are woven throughout our Constitution, and they can exist in statutes even if they're not in the Constitution. I think it's a little naive of folks to think that one strategy would have won where the other strategy lost so badly. I think the answer to that is that we need to shore up privacy even more, not to abandon privacy as a thing we care about because we don't have tools right now written down in the way that we might want to.
Cindy points out that the internet as we know it today was not designed with our rights in mind, and that's the source of many of the problems that we face, especially when it comes to commercial entities gathering our data.
I love technology. I love the benefits that technology can give to us. But the fact that we can click a box that says, oh, I hereby waive not only my privacy rights, but I want to be able to do blah, 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 blah. Like it's all mushed together in one click box, right? Like that's not okay. We need to have all the tools and we need to have the legal and policy structures that stand with us for those tools as well. And some of that information sharing should be a lot harder or a lot clearer to people about what they're doing, a lot harder to have just one click box mean, you know, 20 million different things at once, some of which are important and some of which are unimportant. You know, I just think that there's a way we can structure the world so that we can have the benefits of technology without so much of the bad sides. I mean, nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people. right? And yet that seems to be the predominant business model. Well, that may take some law that says, you know, you can't have surveillance as a business model anymore. I think the goal ought to be to protect users and give them new technologies. I think that's doable in maybe 90% of the problems that we're all facing right now. And then there's the hard 10%.
That hard 10% often falls on the most vulnerable: minorities, queer folks, historically oppressed people, and, of course, women. One place where women differ from men is in healthcare, where we have to make decisions that collide with political ideology. Cindy sees women's privacy and freedom of speech as core values that we need to protect.
People who are seeking reproductive assistance need access to information, and we're seeing increasing censorship of that information by the sources that people normally go to, whether that's social media or even private websites. EFF just did a big report about censorship of reproductive information, and we found that even though the terms of a lot of these companies would, on their surface, mean that this information is available, and of course it's First Amendment protected, people were having access problems. People were having their websites taken down. People were having their Facebook groups taken down. And so even in the context of what's legal, there's a gap between what these companies say they're doing and what they're actually doing as a result, I think, largely of pressure.
In the U.S., Republican-led states are leading the way not only in trying to restrict access to information, but also in using women's online activity to track them and charge them with crimes related to reproductive health.
People are being prosecuted and tracked down based upon their online footprint or even their offline footprint. Things like license plate readers and other offline surveillance are disproportionately aimed at people who are seeking reproductive care, which is a lot of women. So this is a specific area where I think women just seeking healthcare information or healthcare are finding that the lack of privacy and the censorship issues are getting in the way.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation focuses on a few different ways to protect women's online privacy. One is through legal action, but they also focus on education and creating easy-to-use tools.
A lot of online harassment and targeting is aimed at women. EFF has worked with groups around the world to try to put together security trainings for people, and whether that harassment is due from somebody in their own home or somebody outside. So the surveillance self-defense materials are a good place for people to start to kind of set things up to help protect themselves, to be able to get access to the information they need to communicate without having this risk of attack.
Every woman who's online has noticed that the sorts of abuse that people get in response to posting online may be equally vicious, but women get a particularly targeted kind of abuse, often threatening specific physical and sexual violence against her body or revealing information about her that makes her vulnerable. I asked Cindy to weigh in on how this abuse, which is free speech being exercised by men, curtails the free speech of women, who are justifiably more concerned about opening themselves up to threats of intimate violence when they post.
You know, we took an offline problem where women's protection and women's protection from abuse was not handled seriously by law enforcement and people in power. And we moved it over into the online world, and we're experiencing the same kind of situation in which people whose job it is to help protect us and keep us safe from abuse are rotten at it in the offline world, and they're rotten at it in the online world. And I just think it's really important. Like, women have had to publish under pseudonyms for years, right? Because of things like that. So I think that one of the problems is there's just not very much recourse offline or online to women being harassed. And so your ability to come after an abuser and get them to stop is, the tools are not great, right? And they need to be better. Like, you need to be able to get a restraining order against someone for online behavior and have it stick. And again, the problem of restraining orders not working very well is not an online problem. It's a problem in general of the way our society is slanted in ways that protect this kind of abuse. And so I tend to look at that, like, how can we make those tools better so that they're actually available, so that women who are facing this kind of things just don't get shrugged at by the law enforcement if these are actual threats, or on these online communities. I think the other thing that we believe strongly in is having a multitude of places where you can speak and participate. So if one isn't serving you, you can go somewhere else without losing your whole community. This is part of the reason why EFF is very supportive of some of the communities like Mastodon or Blue Sky or other kinds of communities that are not corporate controlled and don't have a surveillance business model. It's to let people be able to build communities that serve them rather than being, you know, stuck in these huge communities where there's a lot of abusers. You know, we've seen an exodus of people, of women, especially off of X, because there's so much abuse there. And luckily, there's some other places that they can go where it's less. It's still not great, but it's better. And I just think that the world in which there are two or three commercial, privacy-invasive products that try to do content moderation for the whole world, it's never going to work very well. Content moderation at scale is not going to work very well. So what do we need to do? We don't need to make the dictators nicer dictators. We need to get rid of dictators and have multiple options for people. I just think that expecting Mark Zuckerberg to get magically better at protecting women online, even if he wanted to, and I don't know, is going to be hard because of just the sheer scale and the difficulty of doing content moderation at scale and doing it in a way that doesn't throw the babies out with the bathwater. The other problem with this is the way that some of these companies are starting to be pushed towards limiting what people can say online isn't in the ways that maybe, you know, you and I would write if we got asked to write it. It's in the hands of the people in power. And right now, what does that mean? That means marginalized people are getting over-censored, even while the people who are the actual people that I think you and I might agree need more censorship or not. So you have to be careful if you're going to create a censorship magic wand. You also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
This is Suki Wessling of The Babble Re, and you're listening to Wings. We're speaking with Cindy Cohen, Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, about women's online privacy. Cindy and EFF stand against forcing social media to use moderation tools, and that might seem to be the place where they diverge from a common feminist approach. I asked Cindy to address the question that you hear women asking a lot. Wouldn't it just be easier if we required people to use their real names in online social spaces?
Look, they have done scientific research about anonymity, and we have a gigantic example in front of us, which is Facebook, right? Which requires real names. People aren't nicer to each other. This idea that anonymous speech allows people to be meaner to each other or to harass people more isn't actually borne out by the research. And I don't think it's actually borne out if people step back and look at it. People aren't nicer to each other on Facebook than they are on other platforms. So I think even our lived experience, if you step back and think about it, is not consistent with this idea that anonymity is the problem. Right now, we have people who harass with impunity. You can find them. It's not actually all that hard to find most of them. I mean, the number of people who can legitimately handle being untraceable online if they're engaging in a campaign in harassment, it's very small. It's that they're not being caught. It's that nobody's trying to catch them. It's that the cops say, oh, there's a VPN, there's nothing I can do. Of course there is. When they're trying to go after drug dealers, they can go past a VPN, right? Like, so I just think it's a problem of will and enforcement and not a problem of the technology. It's because historically, women's concerns about harassment haven't been taken seriously by the people who are supposed to protect us. And I think until we address that problem, all the getting rid of anonymity in the world is going to end up hurting those marginalized people. Look, EFF does human rights work all around the world. the ability to sneak information out of a repressive government, and using anonymity, VPNs, tools like Tor, it saves lives. We wouldn't know the things we know about the Taiwanese fight for freedom. We work with a lot of Chinese democracy people. Now we've got people in Ukraine, we've got people in Gaza, we've got people, I mean, all over the world, Sudan, people all over the world who need to get information out of very scary places where there is official censorship. They need these tools and they rely on these tools. And if we decide that because cops aren't willing to investigate harassment, we're going to get rid of these tools, I think we're cutting off the people we're hurting. You know, it's not the right move to remove anonymity from everybody because some people misuse it. We have other tools to deal with abusers, but lots of people would like you to think that there's a technological fix for this. And if we just remove anonymity online, it'll all be well. I'm here to tell you, I don't think that's going to work. And you're going to hurt a lot of people along the way. And some of those are the same people you think you're helping.
It may sound sexist to say this, but it's literally not. One of the places where women's privacy is most violated is in online shopping. We are more likely to shop for our entire household rather than just ourselves. I asked Cindy to talk about the ways we're being tracked and the results of that tracking.
You know, there's a lot of tracking of us. There's also a lot of analysis of other people like us and people who we communicate with. Sometimes, you know, I often get the, oh, my phone must be listening to me because I was talking to my friend about, you know, this shirt. And the next thing you knew, I got an ad for the shirt. And, you know, I always kind of have a good news, bad news answer to that. The good news is they're probably not listening to you on your phone. And the bad news is they don't have to because you're not that unique. Other people's preferences, people are micro created into these little categories. And so you end up getting the ad for the thing you were talking about. Not because you're the only person in the world who talks about it, but because you're not the only person in the world who talks about it, and people tend to be segmented. So again, the good news, bad news is the good news is they're not tracking you individually at that level very much. The bad news is they don't have to because they've got you segmented into, you know, mom with two dogs and, you know, a bad chewy habit, which would probably be me. And so the result for you is the same, which is you are tracked, and that tracking is organized and analyzed in ways that are increasingly marshaled against you. And we're beginning to see, I think people are beginning to see a lot more clearly the against you part of that, where we're starting to see what we call price discrimination, where the amount that you pay for something is based upon the fact that the companies who are charging you have all this other information about you and your ability to pay and your desperation for the thing that leads to you being charged a higher price than you might otherwise be charged. We just saw a report out of the New York Times about this, about home insurance, where people's credit rating was being used to decide as part of deciding how much they paid for home insurance. And what they decided is if you've got poor credit, they can charge you more for home insurance and you will pay it. They know that you will pay more for home insurance if you've got a weaker credit score. I suspect in other situations it might be flipped, where if they know you've got more money, they're going to charge you more for certain things. But, you know, I think that strikes a lot of people as really unfair. And it's a result of this surveillance business model kind of coming to its natural conclusion now that they've got all this information, they're tracking us all the time, and they've got the analytical ability to set prices, you know, dynamically, and they don't have to set one price for everyone. They're going to start trying to maximize how much they can pull out of your wallet for each transaction. And we're starting to see that more. Of course, we see it on the other side as well, which is the kinds of things you get ads for are based upon who they think you are. And there's a famous, somewhat dated now, Facebook story about how women who were doing job searches on Facebook would not see ads for CEOs or higher paid jobs. They'd see ads for housekeepers and secretaries and things that are traditionally female jobs. And I don't think it's because Facebook was evil. It's because when you feed in data about the jobs that people have traditionally had, it's going to spit out the same jobs. That's another area where the fact that they're tracking who we are results in, you know, really, I think, horrifically discriminatory experiences online that can really affect us, that really impact people's lives in a real way.
And on top of all that, here comes AI. Cindy mentioned earlier that harassment on the internet is hard to deal with, not because it's different from real-world behavior, but because our real-world tools to deal with harassment are so poor. I pointed out to Cindy that because large language model artificial intelligence is based on the sum of human content on the internet, and that content is often sexist, not to mention racist and just plain factually incorrect, we have a bigger problem looming.
There's a whole field of AI research called alignment and other kinds of things that are trying to combat that, but they're kind of trying to put a Band-Aid on something and adjust it. And it's hard to marshal the resources to fix them. And public input into these things could be a helpful way to get started. I think a comprehensive privacy law that just says you don't get to spy on people as your business model would be another way to go about it, maybe a little quicker.
My final question for Cindy was about age verification requirements, which are being promoted as keeping kids from harm on social media and online pornography. Cindy says that age verification can work for pornography websites, but when the push is for a broader and vaguer sense of online safety for kids, she and EFF hear warning bells.
What they're trying to do is to say age appropriate for anything that might be harmful to kids, and that's a much broader term, and it includes things where I don't think everybody agrees. If you go to a red state and you talk to conservative people, they don't think having access to LGBTQ content or trans content, they think that harms kids. So I don't think anything, you know, most of the pornography sites are charging and they need identification. I think that the thing that we're fighting now with a lot of the age gating is this idea that some stuff is harmful to kids, and that's a much broader category, and it's why EFF is so concerned and think it's a really bad idea. Because if we don't have a shared agreement about what's harmful to kids, then you're just handing a censorship tool to people. And so you can get really tricky. Like, we've spent years trying to help women who have breastfeeding forums continue to have their forums when they get flagged for nudity because somebody's taking a picture and saying, like, she's not latching, how does this work? Or I've got this, you know, rash or something, what does this look like? And they get flagged as pornography. So again, I think that we have to be really careful when we think about how we want to respond to these problems. And it's quite often women who end up getting sideswiped worse by these kinds of things, because a lot of women's health depends on us being able to be honest about our bodies, and it gets labeled pornography by a set of people who, if they're in charge, that's what happens. And I've spent probably the most consistent amount of time over the 25 years I've been at EFF trying to make sure that women can talk about breastfeeding online, as I've done almost anything else, because of society's uncomfortableness with women's bodies.
Cindy Cohen wrote a book, a legal memoir called Privacy's Defender, about her work with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Although the book chronicles the losses alongside the wins, it offers an essentially optimistic and positive view of this online world we've found ourselves in.
There are real problems, and I, you know, obviously I've spent my life trying to fight for a better online world, and we have not finished with what we're doing. But sometimes I think it's easy to miss what we've gained. I'm in New York City, and I think you're in Santa Cruz, and we are having a real-time conversation that I'm not worried about how much this is going to cost me, right? It's a whole new way for people to stay connected that didn't exist in the same way before we had this. I'm watching all of the organizing that's happening right now against the excesses of this administration. It's all organized, you know, online, even if there's offline in-person things, which are really important, it's a mix. It's not one or the other, right? And they feed each other, and people are using the tools. I wish that more people were able to use more private tools, but that's happening. This organizing is being made possible because of the digital network. So I still am excited about the prospect of that. We have to fight. You know, John Perry Barlow once told me, no one gives you your rights, you have to take them.
Yeah. Women know that we have to take our rights, and we've worked hard to do it. But the job is never done, and the online world offers new and confusing challenges. Do we protect our privacy and the privacy of those we disagree with? Thanks to Cindy Cohen of the Electronic Frontier Foundation for speaking with me and explaining the challenges so clearly. You can find more information and some excellent tools for safeguarding yourself and those you love at EFF.org. For Wings, this is Suki Wessling of the Babblery. Learn more about my show at babblery.com. The song Silence is courtesy of Unwoman at unwoman.com. Thanks for listening.
Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cohen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Are you between 14 and 30 years old and interested in organizing a French language activity for youth in your community? The VIF program can make it happen.